Good afternoon and good morning, everyone. This is Diane Dosis from Praxis International, and I will be moderating our discussion today. Today we're joined by teams from three different classes, as opposed to your strategy sessions when you're just with your class. We have class G, H, and I together today, so welcome to everyone. This is our second affinity discussion on the topic of lessons learned from attending site visits. And because we have three classes going on at the same time, each of you is at a different point in the site visit process. So those of you in class I will be beginning your planning for your site visit after your three-day institute, and that's coming up for you in March. Class H have mostly scheduled your site visits, so you may have some questions for our Class G participants, and those of you in Class G have nearly all completed your site visit. So we're joined today by one of those participants from Class G, Kelly Brown. She's with Next Step from Ellsworth, Maine, and we'll be hearing from her about her site visit. So on our first call in the series, we explored how host sites are organized to engage those most impacted by an issue and learned how they build leadership within their communities. On this call, Kelly will be sharing with us her site visit experience and reflecting on how she might be incorporating some of the host site strategies into her own programming to strengthen social change advocacy. So we look forward to hearing more about her thoughts. And while Kelly is sharing her experiences with us, we really do want to welcome all of you to ask questions or make comments. And I'm just going to ask Liz to join us and tell us how our listeners can do that. Liz?
Of course. Thanks, Diane. Hi, everybody. Happy New Year. So since this is an audio conference, you all will be able to open your phone lines and be able to talk directly with our speakers, our small little panel today. So that's the good news. It will be a little bit easier in that way to be directly interactive, and we want you to do that at any time during our discussion. You can press star zero on your telephone keypad, and that will
Star one.
Star one. Thank you, Shane. Thank you, Shane. That star one will get you into the operator's question queue. And with just a little bit of patience, after you wait a few moments, Shane will open your phone line, and then you'll be able to relay your comment or your question with the whole group. And so just remember, that's available at any time during your conversation. If you prefer to use email for either a technology issue or for your comment or question, send your note to liz@praxisinternational.org. You can do that anytime during our call today. And finally, this call is recorded, and so if you want to listen to it after the session is done, you can do so on the protected class page of the ALC web pages, and it will be posted there after about a week's time, so just know that. So that's all I have, Diane. Back to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Liz. In addition to Liz, we have Sandy with us from Praxis, and Sandy will also be participating in our conversation today. So as you know, the 18-month ALC course has several different components. We have face-to-face events, webinars, keynote lectures, e-learning course, and, of course, the site visits. What some of you may be less familiar with is the history or herstory of the ALC. I want to briefly describe this because these roots really give us some perspective on the role of site visits in as part of the big picture of the ALC. So the ALC began with a visioning meeting in 2007. Advocates from all over the country convened to help determine what a national advocacy learning center might look like. And one of the things that came up that advocates mentioned, and OVW, as one of our funders, acknowledged, was that there was funding that was available for ongoing training for practitioners such as prosecutors and law enforcement, but not the same kind of funding for advocates. So advocates did not have the same kind of opportunities to come together to really think about what it means to do advocacy. OVW really supported the notion of strengthening advocacy across the country, and Praxis was awarded initially a two-year planning grant to develop the ALC. ALC is now operated in partnership with OVW and Modavi. So the visionaries that were involved in that initial conceptualizing of the ALC, which included advocates and experts from around the country, and Ellen Pence and Amanda McCormick, recognized that ALC participants could learn a great deal by observing what other programs were doing to address social issues in addition to domestic and sexual violence. So social issues such as poverty, housing, racism, and work being done for social justice and social change. We decided early on that one component of the ALC course would be site visits, with the purpose of giving participants an opportunity to learn from these workers and see firsthand some of the intersectionality between their work and ours. So that's it in a nutshell, but I want to invite Sandy in to tell us a little bit more about the role of site visits and what it was. I wasn't part of the ALC, so I was not part of those initial conversations, but so I want to ask Sandy about what was the hope that participants would gain from their site visits. Sandy?
Oh, okay. Hello, everybody, and Happy New Year. It's nice to be. I took a couple, almost 2 weeks off over the holidays, and it's kind of nice to be back to work and welcome you all back into the ALC. One of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about is, well, actually, I don't want to say too much about the logistics, but I'm hoping that maybe Kelly can talk a little bit about some of the challenges or some of the good, bad, and ugly of arranging the site visit, especially for Class I participants that are calling in. We learned from other calls that the newer classes really found it beneficial to just get a little bit of a background. So maybe you can talk about that, Kelly. But otherwise, I'm not going to talk too much about the logistics of organizing. I will say that Monavi is our partner in the ALC, as you know, and they oversee all aspects of the site visits, and Priya is your main contact. Most of you have met her through at least one of the face-to-face events. So, and as Diane said, some of the early visionaries included people like Ellen Pence, Amanda McCormick, Ann Marshall, which of course, you know, just makes me very sad because I was just realizing this morning that it's coming up to the second anniversary of losing Ellen. But Ellen was a big part of our planning when we were when we got that initial grant to develop the Advocacy Learning Center. But when we met with all these different visionaries, you know, and programs from all over the country working for social change, we recognized they were, you know, doing a whole lot of work around social justice and doing different things, but they weren't necessarily working specifically to end violence against women. But their work had some parallels and similarities to what we were discussing in the ALC. So when we were developing the ALC and after interviewing advocates from all over the country, doing different kinds of advocates, we were able to break it down. And Amanda McCormick at the time, it was one of our primary architects or writers of the curriculum. And after we interviewed all these advocates, she, you know, identified the six core activities of advocacy that you, of course, you're all learning we're introduced to at the immersion training. But with all that being said and understood, we're now calling the whole sites what we are now calling the whole sites or other social justice organizations use those same skills. They connect with their constituents. They understand the issues. They analyze the issues, strategize, make a plan, see how they're going to move forward. And then, of course, they implement those strategies, and then they sometimes have to go back and adapt and reflect if something isn't working or they want to make it better or whatever. But so that's kind of the connection between the host sites and their advocacy and what we do in our work to end violence against women. Anyway, you know, we're hoping that this will expand your learning experience in the ALC. You can start connecting the dots and making those associations. And you know, so we've included this in the 18-month course. Site visits have become an integral part of the 18-month course, and I, for the most part, everybody that's participated in them has really gained a lot of information, knowledge, and support for their own programs. So, as you know, there's only one person from each program that has the opportunity to attend. But we have several different organizations that hosts are willing to host these sites and let our ALC participants come in. And we've tried to select a diversity of host sites on a diversity of different topics, and some are in very large cities like New York City, and others are in more rural communities such as our house in Mississippi. They're located in various states, and of course, we've said this before, every state except Hawaii and Alaska, and most people moan and groan when we say that, but anyway, they're located all across the country, so we have a diversity of sites that people can visit. And, you know, some of the issues that are taken up include, like, I think Diane mentioned a few of them, but some of them address health care reform, organizing for fair labor standards, reconciliation as a way to address historical trauma addressed by the forced removal of tribal children to foster care and adoption. Kelly visited this program, and she will talk about some of that today. She visited First Nations Repatriation Institute. But other topics include sexually exploited youth, trafficking, any number of things. We also have one that's a justice project group of transgender people inside and outside of the prison systems working for survival and freedom. And, of course, we're hoping that having this opportunity to observe how other social justice organizations do their work and how they take action, that you, as ALC participants, can see what strategies they're using. And hopefully you might be able to incorporate or adapt some of those strategies to make your life easier, you know, as a staff person in your program, or to certainly help those women and children and male victims in your community. So that's kind of maybe kind of a long roundabout way of telling you that that's the main purpose of doing these site visits. But, you know, I look forward to hearing more from Kelly and what she's learned, and maybe we can all learn from her experience as well. So, Diane,
back to you. Thanks, Andy. Thank you. It's always so interesting to me to hear about, whenever I hear about the site visits, I think, I want to go on the site visits, all of them.
I do, too. They're so lucky. We don't get to go.
I know. Because it's so interesting to me. I mean, I think it's just so significant that this was included and the reasons that it was included in the ALC. I think it's such a powerful component, so I look forward to hearing more about it. So let's bring Kelly in. Kelly, welcome, and Happy New Year.
Welcome. Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you. I'm so happy. We're also happy to have you with us today. And looking forward to hearing more. So Sandy mentioned that your host site was the First Nations Repatriation Institute, or FNRI. Could you just start out by telling us about who the FNRI is and what issue or issues they focus on? Again, I think Sandy might have touched on it, but if you could tell us a little bit more about the organization.
Yeah, their advocacy work is to speak for and with the First Nations people who have been historically oppressed for ages, and they were addressing the ways that adoptees had been treated in the past and continue to be taken away from their heritage. And so they really, it felt like two different pieces to me. One piece was how to welcome the adoptees back into their heritage and to help them to connect with family members. And then it was also to address legislators and policymakers about how to prevent this from continuing and how to help those families who were impacted.
Yeah, that was a great summary. I think it raises so many questions for me, and one of the main ones I think of whenever we learn about the oppression that groups have faced and the ongoing implications of that oppression. I think about how much we don't learn in school about that. So it just seems that there's so much we can learn from each of these site visits about the role of oppression. Tell me about what initially impressed you the most about what they're doing, about the FNRI's work.
The first thing that really caught my attention was how much respect there was for the person who was running this policy summit meeting. She just she embraced everybody, and it was you know, everyone there, it didn't matter if they were if they were an attorney, if they were from the legislative branch, or they were from the Department of Health and Human Services or Child Protective Services. There just seemed to be so much respect for the work that she was doing and has done in the past, and there seemed to be a real, it was true networking, and it, you know, I've been in that situation before where it's like you try to get all the players, for a lack of better words, all in the same room, and you're trying to talk about this topic, but I've never seen it done in a way where everyone knew everybody there, or at least it felt that way to me. And there was real open dialogue. And I'm not, you know, I'm still unclear as to how that was able to happen, because all I could think is it took many years of a lot of networking and relationship building, because when I was there, it felt like, okay, let's have a true open discussion. Let's have real dialogue where we're respecting where everybody's coming from. And I think how that was able to happen is it felt like to me the person who ran this, her name was Sandy, and I apologize, I can't remember her last name. I'm sure Sandy Davidson, who's on the line, could tell us, but it was a real...
Kelly?
Yes.
Her name is Sandy Whitehawk.
Thank you, Sandy Whitehawk. Yep. I felt like a lot of it was able to happen because of the true respect so many people had for her in the room.
Interesting. Kelly, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit. So you were there for 2 days, is that correct?
Yes.
Could you just summarize what those 2 days consisted of?
The first day was, most of it was having survivors speak, and they had an opportunity to just tell all of us in the room their experience of being adopted out and the loss of their family connection and the connection to their heritage and their culture and how that was for them personally, and what that journey has looked like being connected again. And there were survivors from all different backgrounds. Some experienced horrific abuse. Others were lucky enough to have good family ties and relationships. But they still, the commonality was the loss of their heritage. And it was really raw, and it was very hard to sit through and to hear those stories. It just very, very emotional. And that was the most of the first day, was really learning about what this thing is and how it has impacted so many people. And then the second day was more about us getting together in groups and talking about how we can create change, whether that change was education or whether it was looking at new policies or things that we wanted to look at within the legal aspect. And I'm forgetting some of the other groups because I was very interested in the education and awareness piece, and that was the group that I participated in, but there were other groups as well.
Mm-hmm.
To address the issues.
Yeah. Wow, so it sounds like it really had an impact on you in possibly a number of ways. Could you talk a little bit about that, about what you carried with you in terms of its impact on you?
The impact on me personally was it opened my eyes to this other form of oppression that is out there, because you said it perfectly when you said, we don't hear this in history class in school. You certainly don't. And I realized that I'm very ignorant about this situation, because I didn't realize that it was still happening and in the way that it was still happening. For example, one of the attorneys spoke. She was an attorney for the Cherokee Nations, and she said this, and it really stuck with me. She said, you know, it used to be that adoptions happened because there were children who needed homes. And so we were finding families that were able to meet the needs of these children. And now there seems to be a change in what adoption is. Adoption is there's families who need children and they're looking for children. And I never thought of it that way. And when I heard the survivors in the room talking about their experience, you could hear that. And that certainly needs to be addressed in our nation. And so for me personally, that's what I really took back for me.
So I'm reminded here, it sounds like a kind of consciousness raising as we talk about at the immersion training, just that process of having, you know, an aha moment or a light turned on and an understanding that you didn't have before. Is that how you would describe it?
A lot of that throughout both days, yeah.
Yeah, and it's so powerful also to think about how that happens, which is not through lecture or being told, but that hearing of stories and you listening. You know, I think of that kind of humble listening that those of us with privilege when hearing about oppression, that to be able to listen with an open heart is such a powerful thing. Thank you so much, Kelly, for sharing your experience and also the ways that it has touched you personally. So we want to continue about that, but also think about what it means for you professionally. So, you know, throughout the ALC, we talk about how practitioners, including advocates, how we're organized in our programs and how those practitioners we work with, whether it's the criminal legal system or child welfare, how they are organized to do their work and how we're organized to do our work. Could you talk a little bit about what you saw in terms of how the Repatriation Institute was organized to do their work? So I'm thinking here about how they're structured and what you might have observed about their staff or board and volunteers.
Yeah, what I saw was it seemed like it was Sandy Whitehawk was really the one coordinating a lot of this work, and so she was very dependent on the board members. And what I noticed was the board members, they were all from different organizations who really needed to be a part of this in order to create change. So, for example, possibly, you know, people from Child Protective Services or other social service organizations or the legal, you know, legislators or policymakers or attorneys. You know, there were people, and to be honest with you, I can't remember who all the people were and what organizations they were from, but it felt like there were people from the board members really created different facets of those organizations that we really needed to be in touch with in order to create change for the work that they were trying to do. So it seemed like Sandy is very dependent on the board members.
Ellie?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Sandy. And like Diane said, I'm pretty familiar with Sandy Whitehawk and the work that she's doing. And just to add to what you're saying, one of their board people is a researcher at the university. So when they're doing their work, you know, to have that board person familiar and ready to assist with any kind of research to back up, you know, what the adoptees were saying on day one there is really an important role. And I don't know if you caught that, and I can't say who else offhand is on the board right now either, but I liked what you said about they have different, you know, the board is a diverse board that helps meet the needs of what, you know, the ultimate goal that Sandy's going for in terms of her work.
Thank you. Yes, that is what I was trying to say. I appreciate that. It's that really felt very important to me, and it was something that I want to try to think more of when we're bringing this back to our work and the work we do. The other thing that I noticed in what they were thinking about in creating the systemic and the social change was in that policy summit, they then utilized those board members, I think, when they broke us out into groups so that we could all have a better understanding, not just of everyone there understanding the First Nations people and the culture and the history of oppression, but also so we could better understand all of the work they did and their rules and regulations and, you know, how they do the work that they do.
Yeah, so thinking about how they're organized and what that means for what they're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that your observations about the board were interesting and Sandy's comments as well, because I think about programs that are involved in ALC and how you work with your boards and how decisions are made about who participates on a board. And, you know, for some programs, there's a big focus on we need people who are going to bring in money. But I think one of the things that I take from your comment is looking broadly at the skills and knowledge that board members can bring, and having a deep understanding of the issue that the organization addresses, but things like somebody who's connected to a university or who is able to do research on something, and just recognizing that there's a whole broad range of skills that can benefit the work of programs, especially when
Diane.
Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off. It just made
no.
Me
I was just
think...
going to. Yeah, I was just going to say, especially when we're talking about a very small program such as Sandy Whitehawk, who it's very reliant on one person who on the staff. So you end up relying, as Kelly observed, on board members as well. So go ahead, Sandy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also made me think about on our last call, too, when we talked about what does this program do, you know, that affects those impacted most by the issue. And, Kelly, you were saying that the adoptees on day one told their stories, and they talked about the impact of being adopted, whether they came from a very loving or whether they were placed in a very loving home or in a home that was abusive or somewhat abusive, they are impacted the most by being adopted, and that loss of cultural identity and heritage, et cetera, is so critical. But all these board members then were there listening to the same thing, so they would hear the impact of forced adoption or the, you know, all the issues that you mentioned when you first started talking. So I think that kind of applies to our programs, too. You know, we need board members to have more than just the skills of, you know, balancing a budget. They need to know the impact of battering and sexual violence, you know, and support that. You know what I mean?
You're so right, Sandy, because that was the thing that intrigued me most about these 2 days was I felt like everything was driven based on the voice of the survivors, based on the voice of the adoptees. Their voice was always there, and everything we discussed was based on that, what they were telling us they needed. Mm-hmm. And what would have been supportive. And I think sometimes in the day-to-day work that we do, we forget that. And you just couldn't do that those 2 days. Their voices were there, they were there, and everything was driven by what they were telling the people in the room.
Right.
I'm going to just jump in and remind people listening that if you have a question or comment, you can participate in this conversation. Just press *1, or you can email Liz at praxisinternational.org if you want to email a question or comment, but we'd welcome your participation. Kelly, I'm really interested in hearing more as you talk about that importance of centralizing the experience of survivors, of those most affected. What do you take from that for your work?
Well, I think we are already trying to, as we plan any event, we're trying more to think about how can survivors be a part of this. And if they can't be a part of it, is it truly the event that we want to create? So, for example, we had a domestic violence awareness walk in one of our communities on October 1st. And once this site visit was done and some of the training through this course, we asked ourselves, how could we have allowed more people to participate who maybe have been directly impacted by domestic violence? And so one of the things we thought of was allowing them, maybe during support group, to ask some of the participants in support group if they wanted to create posters. So that way, if they weren't able to make it to the walk or they didn't feel comfortable coming to the walk, they could still be heard. They could create a poster of what they wanted everyone to think about as we were walking down the streets of this community. We also started thinking about, you know, maybe asking them what kind of event, you know, talking to participants in the support groups or people who use our services and call, say, what kind of event do you think would be helpful and what do you want that event to accomplish? What do you want people to hear? Also, when we're doing events such as going to our Capitol building or speaking to legislators, really making sure that we reach out to victims, survivors, people who we work with, and see if they want to come or see if they can participate in some other way and what they want us to share. Because I think sometimes we assume, and I think we're making pretty good assumptions because we're doing it based on the work we do, but I think we could do a better job of really asking and making sure that they know about the event and asking them to come out, maybe even offering a ride. Hey, we're going. Would you like to come with us? That type of thing. So that's what I took out of it, is just trying more to have survivors as a part of any event that we do.
Yeah, and really thinking, what you're saying is also really thinking about why women, why survivors would choose to participate or what might get in the way of them participating,
mm-hmm.
and then addressing some of those barriers. But even backing up from that, what you're saying is this even an event that, is this an event that we think is a good idea, but survivors might not. It might not be what they would choose.
Right.
So it seems so simple yet powerful to ask, what is it that you would like to see? And it's such a good reminder, I think, for all of us in all of our work to be doing that. I'm thinking about other lessons you may have learned and what you're taking with you and as you apply the lessons from your site visit and thinking about what you might be able to replicate in your program. Was there anything in terms of how they're structured or in terms of how their philosophy and mission guide their work that carry lessons for you?
It, again, with that piece of, it seemed like everybody in the room, you know, they were so on board with this, and there seemed to be a strong understanding of what every person in the room did, you know, the rules and regulations that they fall under, how they do the work that they do. And so for me, I keep trying to think about, and I'm still not there yet, to be honest with you, I wonder how they were able to accomplish that, because by the time I was seeing it, they had already gone through the part, or it felt like they had already gone through the part of, okay, you know, we're networking, we're building a relationship, we're learning about one another, we're learning how we all operate so that we can help the people who need to use these systems or are forced into these systems. And so by the time we were there, it was sort of moving forward from that. And so I would actually be very interested in having an opportunity to just speak with Sandy and say, how did you get to that point?
Mm-hmm.
Because it just seemed like it was, it must have been a lot of preparation. It certainly just didn't happen because she asked people to be there that day.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Go ahead, Sandy.
Well, this is Sandy. It made me think, and because we have the three different classes on, I'm not even sure if any of you have participated in the community advocacy training that is part of the ALC, but it just makes me think of how important it is to build community and what it takes to do that. Now, as I listened to you talk, Kelly, I was just imagining Sandy Whitehawk, however long she's been doing this. I mean, it's like you say, she didn't just say, hey, I'm having this meeting, come on down. You know, she had to build this relationship. She had to talk with people, either face-to-face or on the phone, and educate, inform, motivate, draw them in, get their buy-in and their commitment. You know, I mean, and it ties into that community advocacy work that we all do as advocates, but it also ties in with, you know, building like those CCR teams or the SART teams or whatever. You know, we don't, you know, when we listen to some of the strategy sessions, you know, sometimes it's good to have just a very small group of people working on an issue. But in Sandy Whitehawk's case, she has quite a few different practitioners that have been informed and are committed to working on the issue, and that doesn't happen overnight. So I think that the lesson learned is we can't give up. You know, we got to keep informing and motivating people, drawing them in, because we can't do it alone. We need help from wherever we can get it, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree, because that was the thing I kept trying to figure out, you know, think of how did she make these linkages? How did she network and how did she build these relationships and get the right person in there so that they could move forward? And, you know, so much of that had already been done. And I would have loved the opportunity to just sit and learn from her and see how this could happen, because you knew it happened because of the classes I had taken. I was paying attention to, are we engaged in dialogue? Are we understanding one another? Are we strategizing? How are we implementing? How are we mm-hmm. learning from one another? But there was so much preparation to get to that point. It made it look so easy. And I know from the work I do and the years I've been doing it, it's not easy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was. She's an amazing person and just doing wonderful work, and you could see all the strategizing, but I would have loved to have had the opportunity to really talk with her to see how she got to that point.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think, too, that, you know, that saying, you get more with honey than you do with vinegar. This is one of the things we talk about in the ALC, right, is that, you know, as we're building these relationships and, you know, we don't want to come in and say, oh, you do this wrong and you don't understand and you just don't get it. You know, we want them to hear from those impacted the most, you know, whether it's physically, you know, a woman who's been battered or a sexual abuse survivor, or as advocates, we share their stories so other people learn that this is how these victims, these women, these survivors are impacted by this horrible thing we call violence against women, right? You know, so, I mean, it's, you, what am I trying to say? The short part of it is, you know, she treats people good, she listens to them, and, you know, she doesn't come in there all pointing the finger and blaming them. And I say this only because, you know, in my early days as an advocate, I could be pretty nasty and I would have everybody running the other way because they would know that I was thinking, you just don't get it. And I don't see Sandy Whitehawk or some of these other organizers in our site visits really doing, you know, exhibiting that kind of behavior.
No,
that's why they do
all.
Such remarkable work.
And that, I think, was the piece that it was engaged dialogue. I felt like there was no preconceived idea of where this was going to go. It was true open dialogue. And on the mm-hmm. first day, at the very beginning, it was, okay, you know, here are the survivors. Would you like to come up and share? What do you want to share? And then the second day was, so what do we take from this? What do we, you know, what do we want to accomplish? And there was no preconceived idea of, well, if we share this, then they'll get it. And then we can, you know, mm-hmm. do this, which I admit I have done. It's like, how can I prove my point, you know, but act like I'm engaged in real dialogue? You know, I've done it before.
Right.
But this was true open dialogue with him. Where do we want to go from this? And it was really amazing.
And Kelly, the adoptees, they participated in the small groups.
Yeah.
You said, yeah. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, actually, in the group that I went into, it was education and awareness. So we were talking about how do we, what do we want the community to know, and how do we feel we can share that with the community? What's the best way? And we had the adoptee who was in our group, or the only one I know of. If there was somebody else, they just didn't share that with the group. But the one person who openly shared, she was an adoptee. She wrote down the notes, which I thought was very interesting. You know, not to say that she did not participate, because she did, but she was more listening and writing down our ideas. And then if we had questions about the process, or we just truly didn't understand the impact that would have on an an adoptee or how that all works, then she would give her expertise as someone who had gone through that process. But she really didn't, at least in our group, she, and I don't know if it was planned that way or if that was just her comfort level, but she kept writing ideas down and didn't, wasn't really saying, well, this wouldn't work because of this, or, well, you should think of this, or, well, she just let the process unfold. And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, you know what that, what else that makes me think of is, you know, in the ALC, and when we ask programs to kind of reflect on their own programming or their own policies and practices and whatnot, and I know I've worked in programs where we just absolutely refuse to hear from, I was working in a shelter in this particular program, just, you know, those women needed help, and it was our role to fix them. Therefore, we didn't hear about what they wanted and needed. Now, I know I'm sounding a little dramatic and a little frustrated and exaggerating just a bit, but really that was the message that was, you know, it was a strongly held practice in this one particular shelter that I worked with.
Yeah.
You know, so we did not hear from them, and they were totally excluded. So the process you explained it sounded very open, and there wasn't any notion that this adoptee was somehow tainted, ruined, ignorant, unable to say what she wanted, he or she wanted or needed or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And
no,
I think sometimes... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sandy. I'm sorry.
No, you were going to say something to add to that, and I would appreciate that.
Yeah. In fact, it was just the opposite, because I think she was... we all perceived her as the expert in the room. You know, we were sharing ideas from our organization's standpoint. So, for example, we had a guardian ad litem in the room, and he was sharing how this process has impacted the work he does and how he has seen it impact victims and adoptees. And so, and everybody was there from a different piece. There were other First Nations people from other tribes in the room, and they would share. But she, this adoptee, was very much considered the expert. So as we were talking about how this impacts our work, when we needed the expert's view, you know, okay, so now we need to hear from you, you know, how does this all play out? If this is our, if these are our rules and regulations, if these are the policies we work under, how does that impact this? And if we were to do this, how would that impact you? And then she could share her expertise. So it was very cool the way that played out.
Right.
This is Diane. I just want to jump in with a reminder for everyone listening in that if this is making you think about something about your site visit, I know many of you have gone on them already. We would love to hear from you. You can press *1 or email Liz. Or if you have a question for Kelly or Sandy about the process that at FNRI, please call in. We'd love to hear from you. So this is also, so I feel like I'm listening in too, because this is so interesting to me. And one of the things that I find so powerful about the site visits is having it take us out of our typical work addressing violence against women, and move us into that intersection where we recognize that it would be rare for us to work with any woman, with any survivor, who is only affected by the violence that she is experiencing, that there are all these other factors, often related to oppression, that come into play. And the site visits remind us of all those other factors. So, Kelly, I wonder if you could talk about any thoughts that you had prior to your site visit about what it might mean for your work. And I'm thinking here, were you thinking, gosh, this is an organization that doesn't do violence against women work. What am I going to learn from this? Or can you say a little bit kind of about your before and after thinking?
Yeah, you know, I was just, one, I was so excited to be chosen the person who could go because, as we said before, only one person from your group can go on the site visit. And so I felt very fortunate to be that one who was chosen to go. And I was imagining that this site visit would really help me to plan an event or to really think about, oh, this is something they do. How could we bring that idea back to my community? And in a way it did that, but more what it did for me is it brought back all the core activities and the principles that we're learning in this training throughout, that it's not about an event. It's about, you know, understanding and engaging in dialogue and learning about other policies and how do you strategize and how do you, you know, it's all of those core principles and it's all of those activities and it's it takes time. And it's not just, oh, let's do a domestic violence awareness walk. Oh, let's do, you know, this awareness event. It's really learning about the organizations that you want to invest it in the work that you do. And it's going to take a lot of work. And so it really reinforced that for me. So I had this idea that I was going to see this big event and bring it back to my area. But really it was more seeing, it was more about, wow, we really have to implement all of these activities and principles and strategies. We really have to start doing this and on a day-to-day basis. It's not a one-time event. It's all the time and engaging other people and bringing your community in and making them feel, letting them know they are a part of this. It's not us teaching them. It's we're learning about this together because otherwise it's just not going to work. And so that was, it was very different than what I thought I was going to get out of it, but it was very good.
Yeah.
Kelly, did
Go ahead, Sandy.
Well, I just had a quick question to ask Kelly. You talked before that there were policymakers there, and we all know that the policies that we have in our programs pretty much dictate what we do and how we provide advocacy, right? But then we also have federal and state policies that guide our work. So I just wonder if there were any lessons learned from some of the policy or policy decisions or policy direction. Sandy and the group were taking things that you observed.
I apologize, Sandy. I'm just blanking on how to respond to that.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I was, you know, I just think about, you know, as long as I've done this work and stuff, I think sometimes nothing will change until we change policy. You know, when we use examples like the anti-smoking campaign, you know, where 20, 30 years ago, like if you would have attended this site visit, probably everybody would have been sitting around there smoking. But now because policies have been passed, nobody does that. And if they do smoke, they go outside. You know, or you think about our own advocacy programs where our policies say this particular woman, the policy, like I worked in a program once where the policy said that they had 20 minutes to go into a donation room and pick out clothes for all their children and family, and they had a 13-gallon bag. You know, that's pretty restrictive, especially when some of the families had four or five or six children, right? But it impacts, you know, a woman who's being battered and her children, that policy. So I was just, you know, kind of thinking about if you saw any kind of work being done around policy and policy changes, because I also know that Sandy's very involved with the National Indian Child Welfare Act folks, and know that the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in 1978, and that's a federal law, which is basically the law of the land, right? But as in all laws, and we know this working in our programs as well, that, you know, our state legislator or legislatures or whatever may pass a law, but it takes a long time to implement that law. And the same thing kind of happened with the Indian Child Welfare Act. You know, it was passed in 1978. There's still people that are not in compliance with the federal law. So, I mean, all these things, you know, go through my head when I'm listening to you talk about the work that needs to be done for adoptees and the work that Sandy Whitehawk is doing or what we're doing in our programs.
Yeah, they did. They talked a lot about the Indian Child Welfare Act, and actually in our group, when we broke out into groups, that got brought up that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is all new to me, so please correct anything that I'm saying that isn't quite right, but my understanding was that with this law, it now says that if a child from one of the tribes is adopted out, the tribe has to be contacted first and should be considered, and one of the families within one of the tribes should be considered first to adopt this child. Am I saying that correctly, Sandy?
Yeah, you sure are. That's one of the,
Okay, so with that, with our group, they were talking about a situation where a child was adopted out from the mom, and so one side is claiming that, yes, they did contact the First Nations people. They did do whatever they were supposed to do to contact the tribes to say, here is this child, and I believe it was the father who was one of the First Nations people, and so they wanted to contact that tribe. But the problem was, I believe what had happened was, first of all, they're saying they did it, and we don't really know if that's true. The second part is they're saying, yes, you might I know what it was. They contacted them, but they spelt the name wrong. That's what it was. They had spelt the name wrong. And so this child is now adopted to a different family, and the father is saying, no, I actually wanted this child, you know. And so they were saying, well, you had to have known. I mean, a misspelling, you have to still know. And the thing that surprised me in this group discussion is they were describing that there's actually hundreds of people who claim to be, they claim to be Indian. And they're, you know, they do say, well, I'm part Cherokee, well, I'm part, you know, whatever tribe it is. And so it's a lot of work, a lot of heavy work from the tribes to figure out, are they actually part Cherokee? Are they part, you know, Navajo or, you know, whatever tribe they're claiming to be a part of? And so people from the outside who don't understand that are saying, well, even if we spelled it wrong, you must have known who we were talking about. And it's like, no, in fact, we don't, because we have hundreds of people, you know, claiming to be part of our tribe and wanting to, that connection and, you know, or whatever. And so I'm probably not saying this right, but there was a lot of talk of ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, and how, yes, now that's enacted, but that doesn't necessarily mean it always works, and it doesn't mean that people are always doing it properly. And, in fact, that's a huge mistake, misspelling the name. And that's even if that was, in fact, the problem, which I don't know if it was. I don't think anybody is feeling really confident that that was, you know.
Well, I think the lesson learned here, Kelly, is, you know, that as advocates, we really need to scrutinize and know the laws that are impacted those women and survivors that we're working with. Because, you know, as we know, when laws are passed or whatever, you know, it leaves a lot for interpretation. Now, when you're talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act, that's a federal law, and that could be a training in and of itself. So I won't go into that ICWA federal law right now, but just kind of relate it to what we need to kind of take in as advocates into our own programs. You know, if those laws are written in such a way that they can be interpreted different ways, you know, and I'll use an example. In our state, we have, I think, 86 or 87 counties. So if they pass a law, you know, at the state level around child protection issues, we have 86 or 87 counties that are going to interpret that law a specific way or in a different way or the way it was intended. So as advocates, we need to kind of stay on top of that kind of stuff as well. And it gets kind of overwhelming, but I'm just throwing this out there as, you know, one of those. I'm so sorry, I forgot to turn my cell phone off. I apologize, everybody. Now, what was I saying? Scare the heck out of me.
Well, what I'm hearing, too, it raises so many interesting points for me that I'm connecting to my work as an advocate, is also thinking about the connections that you then make. So you need to make the connections to get some of those people, some of those practitioners involved and to the table. But then what a powerful thing it is for them to be able to hear these stories from survivors, from those most affected, and that may create consciousness raising then too for those practitioners in a way that then benefits those of us trying to do this institutional change work as well. You know, and I just go back to what you were saying, Kelly, about the power of hearing from those most affected and centralizing the experiences of those most impacted. And that can lead to many different things, but one of the things it can do is inform our work as institutional advocates. So we can begin to say, you know what, these are some places where changes need to be made. And then if we've engaged some of those practitioners who are involved, we then have relationships with people in the institutions where we'd like to create change. Didn't that sound so simple? Can't we just all make that happen now?
Yep. I think so.
So does that sound like part of what you were observing while you were there, Kelly?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you observed a lot of that. And it just, you know, again, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but it just, what I took from that is it takes a lot of work and a lot of relationship building and making sure that the survivor's voice is in the room and is leading that discussion and is at the forefront. And it's a lot to think about, and I think we have to give up. I think the scary part for me is that I have to give up some of that control. Mm. You know, I have to allow the community members to have their voice and to explain and to learn from them and not have an agenda and not, you know, to instead, you know, always have the survivor's voice there. And we're going to be led in this together by the survivors. And it's not me, well, I'm the advocate and I'm telling you this and you need to listen, mm-hmm. and, you know, and really letting that go. And that's, it can be very scary when you're really allowing a group to, you know, to take this on and to give up some of that control and allow the group to lead it in the direction and trust that it's going to as long as we're always listening to those survivors and they're in the room and they're an active participant, it will go where it needs to go. And it's hard to give up some of that control.
Yeah, and that just reminds me of the pillars of oppression, you know. And that's how the oppressors, I'm sure you all remember this from the immersion training, right, where the oppressors, one of those pillars is, you know, you keep that group oppressed by withholding knowledge and making them lesser than and, you know, all these different tools of oppression and, you know, silencing them. And if we do that, too, in our programs, you know, that's why I said earlier, you know, hopefully folks can attend these site visits and take something back that's really going to change and strengthen how they do advocacy so it benefits the women and survivors using our programs. And then I think it lessens our load. You know, when we give up a little of that power that you're talking about, Kelly, we just don't have to do it all. We have help. We can't do it alone. You know, there's more and more bodies and minds and spirits that are moving the work forward, and I think that's really powerful.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it really is. You know, Sandy, I'm also reminded, as you talked about the pillars of oppression, about oppressors trying to keep those most affected separated. And
yeah.
So that it's a really, it's an act of creating change and resisting oppression by coming together and those of us doing the work, helping to bring together those most affected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the how we create change as well, to create opportunities for that.
Mm-hmm. And it definitely ties into that role of forced removal of tribal children, which is why the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in the first place, in which guides a lot of Sandy Whitehawk's work, and why it's so important to her to bring those adoptees into the discussion. You know, when the oppressors were removing children, separating them, like you were talking about, Diane, you know, that's like breaking up that family and everything. So, you know, the work that Sandy Whitehawk and her allies and stakeholders are participating in has really been inclusive and empowering for all involved.
Yeah, and the other thing that I see it doing from what you're talking about and Kelly's talking about is creates that shared experience. So it moves it from being an individual problem, individual issue, to a social problem. And what a powerful thing that is. And I think that's something that really translates to our work in ending violence against women. That if we see it, as we talk about throughout the ALC, we see this as a psychological issue or an individual issue. It's not getting at the roots of what will create change. Kelly, I wonder, actually, do you have anything that you observed or any thoughts on how you saw the issues that FNRI addresses, how you saw them doing that from a social addressing it as a social problem versus an individual problem?
I think it's a lot of it was based around our society and how you know the oppression still continues with Native people. It's for Native people, there's still that oppression happening. There's still those beliefs. There's still the racism that's there. And so if you have, for example, if we, you know, if Child Protective Services, they're looking at certain things as, okay, this is how we define how a child should be taken care of. This is how we define this or that. But actually, if you're not taking the culture into play, if you're not, you know, looking at, well, this particular culture believes this is the way we raise children, and it's actually very very much a community thing, and we all take a part in that, you know, so it could look very different. So what one culture might think is not appropriate, another culture might say, oh, but this is actually how we do this, and this is what it looks like, and this is, you know, and so, you know, we're setting laws, we're setting standards based on a cultural belief, and we're not taking into consideration this other cultural belief. And so we certainly talked a lot about, well, this is a societal issue. This is, you know, this is what it is. And so we have to educate all of the community about, you know, about all of these different pieces. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's a tribal community or whether it's a Hispanic community, or, you know, we have to look at all cultures involved. We can't just say these are the rules and one size fits all, and we have to take that into consideration. So we certainly, there was a lot of talk and discussion about that and how you change, how you help everyone to understand all different, you know, cultural pieces before we make a determination, or before, you know, and to make sure everybody's involved in that discussion.
Definitely. And again, makes me think of some of that. How do we try to anticipate unintended consequences? And to do that as much as possible before taking action or creating a policy, or, and also, you know, as you talked about the site visit, making you think about all the core principles and core activities of social change advocacy, I think about that reflecting and adapting. So when we learn, as we have over and over again with different policies and laws and procedures, that they're problematic for a particular group, or that we then create change. We change them, change the ones that we're able to change. I wonder, Kelly, you know, feel like we've talked a lot about some of the philosophy, and I just had a couple of nuts and bolts questions, because we've got some folks on the call who have not done their site visits yet, and I wondered if you could just talk briefly about your process of choosing and then actually going on the site visit, a couple of details about the process.
Yeah, it was very nice because we received a sheet that had all the different sites that we could possibly go to, and you had an option. You were able to choose three of those, and you could put them in order of your top choice to your least favorite, but all three being ones that you would really like to go to. And from my experience, it wouldn't matter which one you were picked for. They were all pretty cool and very interesting and very different from, or most of them were pretty different from the work that we do day to day. So, and I thought that was really exciting. But you got to choose your top three, and then it took a while, and you received notice saying, okay, this is the one that you were chosen for. And then you would hear shortly after that, you heard back about how you would get there, you know, the different flight choices and different motel options, or what motel you'd be with. And you heard who you were going to go with, because as I said before, only one person from your agency can go. And so you're actually going to go and meet other people from other organizations there, but it will be one of your class, you know, two or three of your classmates. There were three who went with me. There were two others, three total, who went to our site visit. And so you heard who those people would be, and then you were able to meet up with them at the motel. And we were able to go the day before the site visit actually took place, so we were able to kind of get settled in, get your agenda and everything, and then the bus took us right to the site visit, right from the motel. So that made it really easy, and we were able to go there, stay the day, and then the bus took us back to the motel afterwards.
Great, thank you. And I'll just do one last shout out if anyone has any questions or comments. Star 1 or email Liz at praxisinternational.org. Or if you have anything to add to Kelly's description of her site visit process, happy to hear from you. And let me turn it back to Sandy for a minute. We're wrapping up here in the next couple of minutes. Sandy, did you have other questions for Kelly or other observations?
Wow, you put me on the spot. But earlier when...
Are you on your cell phone right now? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, I'm talking on my phone. No, I'm not. Oh, that scared me. Anyway, I was thinking earlier when we were talking about unintended consequences, you know, and when we're working, you know, as advocates, we wear all these different hats and... you know, part of our message in the ALC is, you know, how can you organize so, you know, there's less stress and less strain, you know, but you can do more. I think, Kelly, from what you've described, you know, Sandy Whitehawk is pretty much a one-woman organization. She really utilizes the volunteerism from her board and other community members. And, you know, those are things that, you know, like we can take back into our own programs and benefit from that. I know First Nations Repatriation Institute isn't the only one of our host sites that does similar things. When we get report backs or debrief forms back from those that have participated in this site visits, we've seen so many different comments saying, I can't believe how much they do with such a small staff. And, you know, that's our problem as advocates. You know, we have very small staff and this mountain of work and things we want to do and need to do, you know, to keep women and children safe in our society. So, you know, I just am really encouraging all of you that are calling in and that have are going to your site visit, or for those of you that have already gone, you know, try to integrate as much as you can and see what you can take back and, you know, lessen your load. And like I said before, the more we have involved in doing the work, you know, because it is a social justice and a societal issue. Like we said in the immersion training, you know, when we had the big global violence, you know, for every woman or survivor that we help feel better about the situation she's in, there's 5, 10, 200, 10,000 behind her that are being violated by physical or sexual violence. You know, so we're trying to address this as a social problem, and I think all of our host sites really have some strong lessons that we can take back. And the other one thing that, as I was listening to Kelly, you talk, and Diane, sometimes we pass what we think are good policies. But again, it kind of ties back to those pillars of oppression. Those in positions of power in that can really influence and shape how things happen. And I just want to use the example for tribal people. And I won't get into this too much because of treaty and treaty rights and what have you, there's over 550-560 federally recognized tribes in the country. And because of federal policy, treaties, and whatnot, those tribes have the inherent right to govern themselves. But the reality is that those in positions of power have not allowed that to happen. So I say that as a lesson to all of us doing this kind of work, too. We have to be... It kind of ties in with what I was saying before about how laws are interpreted. You know, if we pass what we think is a good piece of legislation that's going to protect survivors and victims of battery and sexual assault, and then a county or a community interprets it a certain way and there's no enforcement, I mean, those are all things we got to kind of keep tabs on. And those are some of the things, you know, like when you go on these site visits, if you keep analyzing and digging and, you know, really looking at what they're doing and how they're doing it and how it impacts us, you know, you can come up with all kinds of, I think, really helpful things, I think. I mean, that's how I think about it anyway. So I just wanted to add that, Diane.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate that, Sandy, and I think there's so much I've learned from this conversation and continue to learn. And, you know, even as we talk about unintended consequences, I think it is so important to look at those pillars of oppression and recognize that it's not always unintended, and that oppression, mm-hmm. oppressors use deliberate strategies.
Exactly.
And you know, and the strategies used against Native people were part of a deliberate process to erase a culture, and that we have to recognize that and continue to recognize that as well, and to consider what the implications are as we look at our work to end battering and sexual violence. So I appreciate all of your observations that you've shared with us, Sandy, and you, Kelly, as well. Kelly, I wonder if you had any closing thoughts for us today.
I just really appreciate all the work that Praxis did to coordinate all of this and to give us this opportunity, because I think it's so important to step away from your day-to-day work and see all the wonderful and amazing work that so many women are doing out there, and to get refreshed and excited again, and to have these new ideas and to be able to bring it back to your work, and just to remind you that there's so many different pieces out there and so many people out in our community who do want to make a difference. We just have to know how to engage them and bring them in, but it is possible, and we're all going to get there.
Absolutely.
Kelly,
go ahead.
This is Sandy. I just wanted to thank you. You were so articulate. You shared so much, and I think you really took a lot away from that site visit, and I'm hoping the callers really benefited from that. I'm sure that they did, because you did an amazing job of articulating it. So I just wanted to say thanks.
Oh, thank you, Sandy.
And I'll echo those things as well, Kelly. I think one of the ways that we all benefited from you sharing your experience is that while we didn't get to go on that site visit, we all get to take a little something from it because of you sharing what you learned there. So thank you so much for sharing that. And before we wrap things up, I'm going to ask Liz to come back in and let us know about any announcements for our classes.
Good. Thanks, Diane. So just a couple of things. There will be an evaluation of our discussion today that will come to your inbox in just a few minutes. And so it's always super valuable and appreciated by us. So please just take a moment or two, if you would, to share your thoughts about this discussion or future discussions. We rely on your feedback for all of the planning that we do for the ALC. We won't come together again for an affinity discussion until, I have to flip ahead here, it's going to be a little while, until March. So we'll have a few months yet, but watch for your publicity as always, and you'll get a little reminder about our next affinity discussion. And so that is all I have. Thank you, everybody, for participating today, and of course, Kelly, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your grace with us on this call today. It was really interesting to listen to you and so beneficial to hear about your experiences. So thank you for that. And Sandy and Diane, as always, thank you for facilitating our call. And to all of you, Happy New Year.
Thanks, Liz. Hey, Liz, did you want to do a shout-out about the keynote?
Oh, yeah, of course. Good idea. So our keynote will be shared between all of your classes, GH and I, will be Wednesday the 15th. So That's right. That's just a little less than 2 weeks away. Yes. Publicity will go out for that on Monday. That it's a webinar, so, of course, you're all familiar, registration is required. That our keynote speaker is going to be Dana Edel, and she will be talking about organizing girls around the sexualization of girls and women. And so it will be, it's guaranteed to be a fascinating and relevant topic. So I hope you all will be able to participate. Make sure it's on your calendar, Wednesday, January 15th, 2 o'clock Central Time.
Great. Thank you, Liz. Yeah, and I want to reiterate that it will be a really great keynote. It's part of the Dana works with the Spark movement, and some of you may have heard about some of the work that they've done engaging girls and girls as leaders in addressing oppression and the sexualization of girls. So it'll be really great. Again, thank you to Kelly, especially thank you to Sandy, as always, and thank you to all of you for joining us today for our affinity discussion. We hope those of you who have already been on your site visits have learned as much as Kelly did and have taken things back to your programs, and we hope those of you who still have them ahead of you have learned something about questions that you might ask and ways that you might be thinking about the site visit before you go and while you're there as well. So thank you all for joining us today, and I hope this also has reminded you that we are connected globally in a movement toward social change, and that there are people working everywhere for social justice. So on that note, Happy New Year, and this first call of the new year is now over.